You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from the 27th of March. And on the programme today, we found out why your sweet treats this Eid and Easter are likely to cost quite a bit more. It comes down to the price of cocoa. We found out why that's soaring and how you can make sure your chocolate is fair trade and farmer friendly with LJ Loftus from Fairtrade International. And we also caught up with Iman Sugitan, who's from the Dubai-based company Co Chocolat. Meanwhile, you might have noticed that your children smell and that their smell changes as they get older. Dr. Hélène Loos, who's an aroma researcher at the Friedrich Alexander University of Erlangen-Nuremberg in Germany, has undertaken an extensive study to find out why, and she joined us on the radio. And a major banking figure in the United States is suggesting that the world is facing a looming retirement crisis. Larry Fink reckons the gap between what we're saving and what we need is a big and urgent problem. So on the show today, we talked pensions with financial independence coach Steve Cronin. Lots of people sent in their questions and we got some really fantastic free advice. So it's well worth having a listen. And then, off the back of our conversation yesterday about scams, we found out that there's at least one fake website selling tickets to the Museum of the Future. Tech expert Maha Yamut from Kaspersky told us why it hasn't just been taken down. Hello there, welcome back to the show. Right, we are going to discuss chocolate on the programme today. Came up with that. That's just brilliant. I asked the production team to give me like a chocolate song or something sweet. And that's what they came up with. It certainly enlivened our discussion. Because as we fast approach Easter and Eid, I need to recover now. Those are, of course, religious festivals when we traditionally gift sweet treats. And it has emerged that unfortunately, chocolate in particular is actually going to cost more this year. And that's in part because of the soaring cost of cacao. Now, global warming is apparently to cause, it's to blame. It's causing poor growing conditions. And that means that actually it's hit the headlines this morning in particular. The price of cocoa beans is, I'm saying that wrong, it's cacao beans, is more than three times their cost in March 2020. Prices are now hovering around a record $10,000 per tonne. So, unfortunately, chocolate's going to cost more for the consumer. But what does that mean for the farmers? Are they maybe doing better out of this shortage? Let's find out more. I'm joined on the line now by LJ Loftus, who is Deputy Director of Partnerships at Fairtrade International, which is an organisation that works to get a fairer deal for farmers and workers in developing countries. LJ, thank you very much indeed for getting up early and joining me from the UK this morning. Tell me, I'm going to start with a really sort of obvious question, but where do these cocoa sort of beans that are the basis of, I'm saying it wrong still, where do these cacao beans come from?
Yeah, and I often just say cocoa beans. The majority of the chocolate that we consume comes from West Africa. So the Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana. So that's where the majority is coming from. And most farmers in West Africa are living below the extreme poverty line. So it's a really, really challenging job to be a cocoa farmer.
So they're not going to be making more money because their beans are costing more. That just as a guess.
Yeah, I mean, on the surface, you think high prices, great, this is going to look and be really good for farmers. But sadly, you know, when it eventually filters through to the farm gate, these underlying issues that are causing the increase in prices are really concerning. So, I mean, it's been really dramatic and kind of drastic increases. And as you said, it's been triggered very much by actually a drop in supply. So there's not enough cocoa. They're really struggling, cocoa farmers, with diseases on their crops and losing crops. And this is all because of climate change, rising temperatures that they're dealing with, rainfall that's coming at different times. And then on top of this, if you're a cocoa farmer now, the reality for you is that you're going to be dealing with huge increases in the cost of production, so the cost of doing cocoa farming, and then your cost of living. And it's going to just be crippling inflation. And I don't know how much you know about cocoa, but it is so boom and bust. So the price is so unsustainable, up and down. And if you imagine for a small, like family holding a small family farm, it's so hard. You need stability and you need to be able to invest in your farm. And importantly, they need to be able to adapt to the climate change that is happening. So these high prices with low productivity, it's just trapping farmers in poverty, and it's threatening the cocoa that we all enjoy, particularly at this time in Easter.
So, do you know, when I said I was going to do this subject on the radio, somebody said, you know, it's a really controversial subject. And I was like, how can it be controversial? It's just the growing of cocoa. But I think there's quite a lot of big organizations involved in making the chocolate that goes on our shelves. And is there a suggestion that those very big money-making organizations aren't really paying the farmers enough money?
What we do at Fair Trade is we support farmers to get a fair price. So there's so many organizations globally that are absolutely trying to do the right thing. They are buying on fair trade terms, which means farmers get an additional sum of money so that they can invest in their future, so they can invest in their communities, so they can put enough food on the table, so they can look at education for their children. But in addition to that, what we do for fair trade cocoa is we actually have what we call a safety net price. So when the market goes boom and bust, as it starts to drop, we have a minimum price that says it won't go below this. And this just supports farmers to have more stability within that pricing cycle. So, I mean, in the UK, I'll be enjoying chocolate eggs from the Co-op. I'll be enjoying them from Aldi, Lidl, Waitrose, and then Tony's. I don't know if you know Tony's, the chocolate brand. They're also doing Easter eggs. But there's lots of great partners that we have around the world. Maltesers as well is fair trade in the UK.
So we have some of those products over here in the United Arab Emirates as well. We have a Waitrose. And how can you be sure that when you're looking around and you want to buy ethically, how do you know whether it really is a fair trade Easter egg or a fair trade Eid box of chocolates?
So you look for the fair trade mark. So the fair trade mark is actually a symbol. It's got a person sort of holding up like this, and it's blue on one side and green on the bottom. It's very well recognized in the UK. So if you see that, you know that it's a fair trade cocoa. And that is what we're asking shoppers to do this year at Easter, is first of all, look and buy fair trade cocoa. And then also, whoever you're gifting it to, share with them what you've learned, share how important it is, share that we need to look after and support cocoa farmers to ensure that our families can continue to enjoy chocolate at festivals and celebrations for many, many years to come.
LJ, it's been great to get you on the radio. Thank you very much indeed. I know you've got a long day of interviews ahead of you because everyone all of a sudden wants to talk about chocolate. So thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning on The Agenda. That's LJ Loftus, who's director, or deputy director of partnerships at Fairtrade International. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Now, up next, we are going to find out a little bit more about a local chocolatier based here in Dubai, who actually make their chocolate out of cocoa sourced from the Philippines. In the next few minutes, we will be hearing from Iman Sugatan, who is the creative head at the Dubai-based company Co Chocolat, who says that surprisingly, costs for her haven't gone up. We're going to find out why that is in the next few minutes.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Hello there, welcome back to The Agenda. Right, we are discussing chocolate on the programme today. As of course we are fast approaching both Easter and Eid, both religious festivals when we traditionally gift sweet treats. And it has emerged that chocolate in particular is going to cost more this year. And that is in part because of the soaring price of cocoa. Now, it's all because of global warming. Apparently it's causing poor growing conditions. And that means that the price of cocoa beans is now more than three times what it cost back in March 2020. That means prices hovering around a record $10,000 per tonne. So what's the impact on our local chocolatiers? Is that the phrase? Is that how you say it? Chocolateries? Chocolatiers? Are they facing a price rise? Well, we wanted to get a local angle on it. And so earlier I spoke to Iman Sugatan, who is creative head at the Dubai-based company Co Chocolat. And I asked her if her prices are going up.
Honestly, no. And it might come as a surprise to your listeners, but this is because we are not taking our cacao from sources that probably 50 to 70% of the world is taking from, which is in West Africa. We are sourcing our cacao from our very own agri-social enterprise, and we are taking it from the Philippines. So, you know, the Philippines is not known as a bulk producer, but more of a fine flavor, small batch cacao producing country. So we have always been paying a bit more. Not just a bit, but we have been paying more than what our counterparts have been paying over the years. So for us, we are taking from the same sources and we find no shortage of cacao, at least in the Philippines.
Is that partly because you haven't seen climate changes in the Philippines? You haven't seen shortages of beans actually being grown?
We have seen the effects of climate change. I was just telling some people, because we do factory tours in our factory, and we are telling them that before we used to harvest cacao as early as late November, December, this is when the high peak of harvest happens. But nowadays, it's already December and you're still really waiting for that high peak to happen. It's already moved over the years. So we are affected. However, because we are relatively a country whose cacao production is, you can say it's ramping up because people are more knowledgeable of fine flavor cacao production. The production is becoming better, actually, at least for us in the Philippines. I'm not going to say it's anywhere as big as what countries in West Africa are producing. And I believe that Filipino farmers and Filipino chocolate makers are not interested in that either. We just want to stick with small batch direct trade with our farmers producing nice single origin chocolates.
Tell me why, when you started your company, you decided to choose chocolate from the Philippines, knowing that that would make you a very premium brand because the cacao is a lot more expensive from the Philippines.
We did that because we saw the dire situation of farmers. When we went for the cacao production training, it was an eye-opener for us. One of our classmates, he was the one who was telling us, I am going to marginalize the area. I'm learning now because I want to relay whatever knowledge I will gain so that they will reach a target of 100 dirhams per family income for a month. And for us, when we heard that, we were like, 100 dirhams, we blow that in a meal for one person. And that changed things for us. We thought, why look far and wide? And we wanted to create something healthy, something premium, something delicious. So start with a good base, start with a good cacao source. And we thought, yeah, why not the Philippines? Why not empower our farmers at the same time that we are creating our healthy chocolates?
And you say that your chocolate is healthy. And I have to say, as someone who is constantly keeping an eye on her weight, that sounds very appealing to me. Why is your chocolate healthier?
Actually started because my diabetic mom, it's been consciously ingrained in us to ensure that in what we eat, there's less refined sugar. Cacao is a superfood, and chocolates can be a superfood, you know, it has so many benefits. And this is what we are trying to promote: no palm oil, use of fruits, nuts, superfoods, putting it into chocolates, creating functional chocolates. And you'll find it hard to see something like that in the market.
So, as people are shopping for Easter gifts and for Eid gifts, have you brought out a special range for this season? Do you bring out sort of different types of chocolate each year?
Yes, we do. We do. And especially for Eid, we have created flavors which reflect the traditions, the culture, the Arabic culture, the Muslim culture. And this involves kahwa. This involves taking in flavors like baklava. And we also have the Palestinian za'atar. They're normally not included in chocolates, but we have done that, you know, to give it a very Eid flavor.
What type of price differential are we looking at for a bar of your premium Filipino farmer-friendly chocolate compared to a normal bar of chocolate?
If we compare it with, let's say, another bean-to-bar chocolate brand, we would be 32 dirhams. And I'm just basing it on what others are selling. There's another bean-to-bar chocolate maker here in the UAE, and they're selling at 35. But then if you look at the grocery shops, it's bulk chocolate and they're not actually fine flavor. I'm not sure if they're fair trade. You're looking at something like 15, 18 dirhams.
And if people buy chocolate from you, what is the promise you make them when it comes to your relationship with your farmers?
The promise is that for sure we know from whom we take our cacao. We know that there is no slavery, and that's why we have a logo of no slavery on our chocolates, because they do come from ethical sources. And it makes that bite, even that sip or drink of our hot chocolate, much sweeter, because it does empower farmers back in our homeland, the Philippines.
Iman Sugatan, their creative head at the Dubai-based company Co Chocolat, bringing us to an end of our half hour on how you can ensure that your Easter and Eid celebrations are fair trade and supportive to the farmers who are growing cocoa in both the Philippines and elsewhere in the country.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hey there, welcome back to The Agenda. Right, I'm going to kick off sounding a little bit like the business breakfast, because this is a story that I read in the Financial Times yesterday. It all stems out of this really famous banking guy. He's called Larry Fink. He's the CEO of the asset management firm BlackRock. And every year he sort of puts out a sort of state of play letter. He sort of suggests what he thinks are going to be the big things that we need to worry about in the coming 12 months. And in that letter this year, he has suggested that the world is facing a looming retirement crisis. He basically described the mismatch between what the Americans are saving and what they're going to need for their retirement as a, quote, big and urgent problem. And he also highlighted the fact that one in six people globally will be older than 65 by 2050. I think that's me too. And that's up from one in 11 in 2019. Now, for some, you know, there's been lots of other experts for several years, experts in the retirement sector even, talking about there's a huge number, a $4 trillion gap between what Americans need for old age and what they've actually saved. Now, that's interesting, but we don't really want to talk about Americans. We want to talk about what we are doing right here when it comes to prepping for our retirement. Now, I wanted to get an expert on the programme to help us. So I'm delighted to say we're joined by Steve Cronin. He is the founder of DeadSimpleSaving.com. He's a financial independence coach, and he's been kind enough to get up very early in the morning to join us on the line. Steve, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Clearly, 65 is the new 45, I think.
I think it probably is, unfortunately, horrifyingly. And what's great about the fact that we've got you on the line is we're going to keep you for about half an hour. And I hope it's okay, but we're going to ask you to take questions from our audience. To sort of, a couple of people have sent questions in already. But my question to everyone who's listening now is, how much do you think you need for your retirement pot? And are you already saving for your retirement? You know, have you got a pension plan? Obviously, there aren't really pensions. I don't. There aren't really sort of pension schemes out here in the UAE. So, what is your plan? What are you going to do? Get in touch with me. I'd love to hear from you. 4001, or you can WhatsApp me on 0487155500. Steve, I'm going to start with a question from me. How much do you need in your pension pot? It's the $100 million question, or hopefully not.
So, very, very simply, if you have an amount that you want to live on for the year, let's say to keep the numbers simple, you want to live on $40,000 a year, then you can roughly multiply that by 25, and that's how much you would need. So if you were going to live on $40,000 a year, you would need $1 million, just a million.
So, do you
And,
know, I said that on the breakfast show, and all of them looked at me. In fact, they're in the green room now, and they all looked at me as like I was some sort of flash Harry. And I was like, no, I think that's what you need. I'd like to live for longer than 25 years. And I mean, do people manage to save that?
increasingly, people are becoming more aware that they have to do something. There are a lot of people in my parents' generation who are just living on their cash, and when cash is making you 5%, then that's great. But otherwise, they're slowly just depleting their cash reserves, and then they end up relying on their state or their children. And there's lots of people. My Filipino coach friend was saying that, you know, you retire and then you buy a shop, and it's completely unsuccessful, and you burn through all your retirement savings, and then you rely on your kids, and that's what hundreds of thousands of people are doing, and it's a real problem. So yeah, you know, this is an urgent solution, not just for Americans, but for you as an expat, right? Any expat is urgent because there's very few safety nets for us.
Well, I was going to say, the reality for me in the United Kingdom is that if I lived and worked there, then I would get a state pension plus any sort of pension pot that I'd managed to, develop as a consequence of my job. And, you know, when you are fully employed in the UK, you get a pension. That's part of the deal. Of course, that's not part of the deal here. So, how should people here be saving for their pension, for their retirement?
Yeah, so I don't think you need a pension as such because pensions are useful to reduce your tax exposure, and there isn't really any tax exposure here. But you do need to be putting money away regularly, and you have to decide where you want your retirement income to come from. Is it going to come from buy-to-let property, or is it going to come from stocks and bonds, or a bit of both? And they both have different quirks. You know, are you going to be putting up with exploding boilers and solicitors and tenants when you're 80, or are you going to just be not panicking when the stock market crashes? But you do need to be setting money aside somewhere that is not just in cash. Like, you can't be a dragon just sitting on a big pile of cash and hoping that it's going to be okay. So you need to educate yourself on how to invest in stocks and bonds very sensibly, or how to rent out properties. And the more control over you have over this yourself, rather than relying on your bank or your insurer or your financial advisor, the more that you can ask them questions and ask them the right questions and check on the fees or even take control of this yourself, the more independent you are going to be.
This person has texted in. They've chosen to remain anonymous, and I totally respect that. So, if anyone else wants to text in but not say their name, this is a good moment to do it. You can text 4001 or you can WhatsApp me on 0487155500. This person says, I earn 65,000 dirhams and I managed to save 20. I'm a finance person, I'm 48, and I can barely figure out what investment can protect me with a decent life when I grow up. There's bubble property markets all over the world. The bank interest rates, it feels like banks and governments make sure they take the biggest share no matter what you do. Now, I have to say, I slightly am with this person because I have tried to sort of put investments in the stock market. And it turns out I think I put them in at the peak of the market. Things are looking okay now. The markets have risen again, but that feels great at the moment. But what should I do? Should I be taking money out and then putting it back in when the market's low? It's so difficult to know what to do when there is no certainty.
So this is a great point. And actually, there is quite a lot of certainty that property markets and stock markets do go up. You just need a long time frame. Returns on property and on stocks are really quite stable over 10 years. They're just not stable over 1 year or 1 week or 1 day. And so what we think is the peak of the market now is just like really tiny compared to where the stock market is going to be in 2060. So it really doesn't matter what's going on now. You just need to put in as much money as you possibly can and have a long time frame. And it's the long time horizon that's going to save you. And we're not talking about when you move back home or even when you retire. Like if you retire, you're only going to take out like 4% of your stocks per year, which is a tiny amount. So that the rest, the 96%, is going to be in there for a very long time, hopefully until you're 90 or 100 or 110, whatever longevity is evolving into by the time we get that old. So you have a really long time horizon, which means it doesn't matter what the stock market's doing right now. It doesn't matter if there's a bit of a property bubble, as long as the city that you're investing in is relatively stable, then you should be absolutely fine. So I want to encourage people not to be scared of investing as long as you're doing it sensible. If you're buying a sensible property that's got longevity, or you're buying a globally diversified index fund that invests in the whole world, or even the S&P 500 in America, that is going to grow for decades and decades to come. And then this is the message that Larry Fink from BlackRock has. If you invest in those markets, then your money will grow. It will outgrow inflation and you will have an amazing retirement.
Lots of people, Steve, getting in touch. Lots and lots. We're going to crack through them after the break. One message just to give, just to whet your appetite, Steve. Kamala says, is there a good site or resource where you can educate yourself in the intricacies of investing? I will let you ponder on that. We will come back to you in just a few minutes' time.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Yeah, we're talking pensions on the programme today. That is after a major banking figure in the United States suggested that the world is facing a looming retirement crisis. He's a chap called Larry Fink. He's the CEO of the asset management firm BlackRock. And he reckons that there is a big and urgent problem and one that needs to be confronted as soon as possible. Now, the general gist that he's worried about is that there's loads of old people. There's going to be more old people because of the way that the generational shift takes place. And we're not saving enough for our retirement. So my question to you today is, how much do you think you need? Are you saving for your retirement? And what is your plan? Do you have one? Do you have a plan? And if you don't have one, we have Steve Cronin, who is the founder of DeadSimpleSaving.com on the line. He is our favourite financial independence coach, and he is taking your questions. So message in now, and you could be in with a chance of that free advice. Steve, thanks so much for staying on the line. Let me just play you one question that has just come in. Have a listen to... Ooh, let's see if this one works.
For the people who are residents here for a long time in UAE and they love to live here longer, is there any good retirement plan for them?
Did you hear that? Is there a retirement plan for people who want to carry on living here in the UAE into their retirement, Steve?
Well, there's no formal plan, although increasingly companies are moving away from the gratuity, like end of service benefit, and towards some kind of pension-like savings plan. We already see that in the DIFC with the dues system. So that will help a little bit. But really, it's on you. It's on you to control your spending, to earn as much as possible without burning out, and then to invest as much as possible, whether that's in your property empire or in your stock and bond portfolio. And if you're going to get someone else to do it, then make sure you're in control of the fees, because over time, it's the fees that are going to kill the growth of your portfolio. So ideally, you don't want to be spending more than 1.5% ideally 1% of your total portfolio per year in fees. That's where people go wrong when they get trapped in these horrible long-term savings plans or whole life insurance plans. So fees, be really tight on that. Invest regularly, like ideally every month if you possibly can, or at least every quarter, and you'll be surprised how quickly these things grow. If you have $1,000 a month for 30 years, that'll get you to $1 million, or $2,000 a month, you need 20 years, $3,000 a month, that will take you 15 years. So it is possible.
Okay, this anonymous message came through saying, "Hi, I'm 52 years old. I earn 75K a month. I have my own property here that's fully paid up, and I have one in my home country. I've got $1.3 million in cash, stocks, bonds, MF, I don't know what that is, and private equity. Besides this, I've also got 200,000K each for both of my kids' college. I wonder if they'd like to marry me. What do you think is the right amount for me to consider for financial freedom?"
So it all comes back to how much you want to take out each month in retirement. So if they have 1.25 million, you know, that will grow over time to be 1.5 million, maybe 2 million in 10 plus years time. Then they can take out $60,000, $80,000 a year, which is not bad, right? So so they're not in a bad position as long as they're not investing in risky stuff like lots of individual stocks that can just blow up or not do very well. That's why I just prefer to buy the whole market and then get on with my day, focusing on earning more money and spending time with my family rather than like picking stocks. You absolutely don't need to do that.
Basma has got in touch with this question.
"Is it too early to start planning? Is 20s are a good age for starting to, you know, planning for retirement?"
Steve.
Yeah, brilliant. Absolutely. The earlier, the better. You know, if your kid is one, start giving them a stock fund, you know, like that sort of thing. You're never too early to start thinking about these things. Don't stress about them, but just start learning about how the way the world works. And you'll have huge amounts of money if you save regularly from and invest regularly from your 20s, because the market needs time to grow. So again, think about, do you want to focus on stocks? Do you want to focus on real estate? You have time to experiment with those and completely fail and still bounce back if you can save a little bit and invest each month and learn how the stock market works, how a global index fund works, maybe a bond fund works, then you'll be way, way, way ahead of everybody else. So yeah, that's brilliant.
Farhad has written in. He says he's 35 years old. He earns 20K a month. He started investing 5K from January 2024 as an SIP in a mixed bag of Indian and US stock markets. "I plan to retire at 60, Farhad says. Would I have enough retirement funds accumulated by then?"
So again, it depends what you want to live on. You've got two levers that you can control. The first lever is how much you put in every month. The second lever is how much you want to take out every month in retirement. And the more imbalanced they are, the longer your retirement is. So hopefully, if you're able to put in a bit more each month than you want to take out each month, then you are going to have a fairly short time to financial independence. So again, if you roughly like that would take about 25 years to grow to $1 million, just off the top of my head. So, you know, putting in about $1,500. And if you've got that time, then great. And you can always put more in as your salary grows. The main thing is as your salary grows, make sure your expenses don't grow at the same rate. Otherwise, you can't put more into the market.
We have
so
not
really
managed.
That regular monthly investing is good.
We've not managed to do that, unfortunately. Our expenses have definitely grown as we've got older due to school fees, for example. I'm looking forward to when the school fees stop. And I think that might actually be the point where we can properly start to save some money. Now, Benji has sent this message in.
"Setting up financial retirement fund, which is the best option? Stocks, bonds, property, or life insurance?"
What do you think, Steve?
Okay, life insurance is not a savings vehicle. I wouldn't touch whole life insurance. Like term life insurance, it's very simple. Just protects your life if you die. That's brilliant. But it's not for saving and investing. So yeah, you just have to make a choice between stocks and bonds and buy-to-let real estate. You know, they're different beasts. They have different hassle associated with them. And you can do both. You can have a portfolio of stocks and bonds. You can start with like 80% stocks, 20% bonds, for example, and then by the time you're retired, you'd be 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Or you can get some buy-to-let real estate, combination of Airbnb and long-term lets and things like that. So it's really up to you where you want that income to come from. But do start thinking about this. When you're 70, what percentage of stocks and bonds versus real estate do you want to have generating your income? The more you think about that, then the more it will happen and it will actually be there for you. And also it gives you a target to work towards. And, you know, our monkey minds like to have targets. Then we're going to not spend on stupid stuff. We're going to say, oh, I need to get further towards my target. And so that really helps as well.
I've got 30 seconds left with you, Steve, and I want to return to Kamala's question, which is, are there really good sites or resources where you can educate your oneself in the intricacies of investing?
Yes, absolutely. Google financial independence. That's one of the best things you can do. Add your country name in if you want to. Simply FI Facebook group is the most incredible resource. 33,000 people we have in there, safe space for learning about investing. Dare I say, my own website, deadsimplesaving.com, lots of free information about that, how expats and people in the Middle East region can invest simply by themselves. Millionaire Expat by Andrew Hallam, the most amazing book. Go and read that too.
Steve, always lovely to have you join us on the line. Thank you so much for packing so much advice into only about 10 minutes or 10, 15 minutes on air. The questions are still coming, so we'll definitely come back to you another time to do another sort of workshop on how to prepare for your retirement. But in the meantime, thank you so much. It's been great to have you on the radio. That was the voice of Steve Cronin. He is the founder of DeadSimpleSaving.com. He's a financial independence coach and he's awesome.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, welcome back to The Agenda. Right, I have a question for you. It's quite a sort of personal one. Are your children a bit smelly? Has their smell changed as they got older? Well, if you are finding your teenager to be a little bit stinky, according to a new study, you're actually quite right to, because researchers have characterised the chemical makeup of how teens smell, and they've compared it with the smell composition of infants and toddlers, and they have found that officially, children's body odour takes a dramatic turn after the onset of puberty. Joining me now to discuss this further is aroma researcher Dr. Hélène Loos, who is one of the authors of the study. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us on the line. I suppose I have to ask, first of all, how do you measure how children smell? Because I suppose it varies from child to child, and also it's subjective according to the nose of the sniffy.
Yes. So thank you for this question. There are several aspects that we need to consider. The first one is how we sample actually the body odors to further then evaluate them. So this is already a question where there are different methods. We decided to use cotton pads that the participants wear under their armpit for one night. And then you are definitely right. There's not yet a means to tell with a machine how an odor smells like. So what we did is that we asked trained panelists to describe the odors they perceived. So this training at our Chair of Aroma and Smell Research is based on a system of reference compounds where we train ourselves weekly in describing the odor qualities of individual odorants.
So I've got to ask, how did people describe the smell of teenagers versus the smell of younger children?
The samples that we got were actually not that smell intensive. And the other attributes used to describe these smells were, for instance, sweaty, fatty, flowery. And we observed that the babies' odors were a little bit more flowery compared to the other odors. And then in the next step, we looked at the chemical composition, so which odor active compounds were detected in the samples. And here we observed that a range of different compounds was present in the samples with really a huge variety in individual odor characteristics. And it's then the mixture of these different smells that makes up the overall odor. And using an approach dedicated to identify odor active compounds, we determined several carboxylic acids that were detected with higher levels in the body odor samples of the teenagers. So, for instance, these were smelling cheesy, fruity and dried plum-like, musty, coriander-like and fatty, goat-like, wax-like and soapy, and grassy and green bell pepper-like, and also two steroid odorants that we found only in the teenagers' body odor samples that smell like sweat, urine and musk, and sandalwood and musk.
Gosh.
But these are all the odor qualities of these individual odorants that we found in the samples, and the overall odor is always a mixture of these different odorants.
I love how your researchers described some teenagers as being goat-like. That really is quite defined. I grew up on a goat farm, so I know exactly how goats smell, and that is quite a defined smell. I mean, now that you've discovered that teenagers, qualitatively are smellier or smell different to younger children, have you any theories for why that might be? Why are teenagers suddenly become a bit stinky when they go through puberty?
So there is a biological reason that is that the apocrine sweat glands, so this is a specific type of sweat gland that you can find amongst others in the armpit, gets active during puberty. We also know that there are some other compounds that have not been detected with our methods that smell very sweaty and grapefruit-like or onion-like that are secreted by these compounds. So this is the one reason. And why this is so, we think that this is also related to attachment and detachment processes, so that these odors can facilitate parent-child bonding and also detachment. But I think here we also need to do further research.
So does that mean that they don't smell as nice, and so we get used to the idea that they might not be with us all the time? Is it
yes,
that type of thing?
Yes, definitely. So that this facilitates their independence.
Gosh, that is absolutely extraordinary. I have a 9-year-old and a 10-year-old, so far no one is smelly in the household, but I have been warned that everything changes.
Yes. Yes, and that's actually also something we want to have a further look like in the different age classes. So this was really just a first step, this study.
Absolutely fascinating. It's got all of us here at the radio station completely gripped, and I'm sure everyone listening as well. So thank you so much for your time. Amazing to have Dr. Hélène Louis join us on the line. She's an aroma researcher at the Friedrich Alexander University of Erlangen-Nuremberg in Germany. And that was, it's one of the great pleasures of being on the radio that you get to find out all of these intriguing things. And I will be dining out on that one for at least a couple of weeks.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
So we're going to turn our attention now on the agenda away from pensions and retirements to talk about scams. And regular listeners will know that we chatted about it yesterday, in particular the scams involving Dubai Police. And we were really lucky to have Brigadier Saeed Al-Hajri join us. He is Director of the Cybercrime Department for Dubai Police. Now, he had lots of advice. And if you missed it, I really recommend listening back to our podcast, which you can find on DubaiEye1038.com or wherever you find your podcast. Lots of people got in touch with us, though, not just about scams involving Dubai Police. One person, in fact, who messaged us and who actually did get caught out in a scam was Riaz. Now, he wanted to buy tickets to the Museum of the Future for his visiting family. Here's his story.
I quickly went on my phone, basically Googled the Museum of the Future, and a website popped out and it looked like legitimate. I went and selected the dates. I was a bit surprised because I said, normally they're booked. booked. You need to book in advance. But, you know, I said to myself, maybe it's Ramadan. So the whole website looked legitimate. And it was also ranked number one on the Google search. And I went there and booked the date, the time, and the number of tickets. It came to 900 dirhams. Then I entered my credit card details, and it prompted for an OTP number. When I got the message from my bank, it didn't say 900 dirhams. It just had a letter AMD followed by 4,500. Mm. And I was thinking, like, okay, normally dirhams come, but okay, it's not a yen. It's not, you know, like nothing like of those known currencies popped in my mind, you know. And then I entered the OTP, and immediately I saw that I was deducted like in 37,892 dirhams.
That's 37, over 37,000 dirhams. And sadly, he can't get the money back because he put in the OTP number himself. And that got us thinking about why this website hasn't been closed down yet. Now, we've contacted the Museum of the Future. Sadly, they haven't managed to get back to us with an answer yet, but we will keep pursuing that. And we do know that in the past, the UAE has, in fact, quite recently shut down 160,000 websites and social media accounts for, among things, selling drugs, illicit substances, and also promoting bad behaviour among young families. So we do know that websites can be shut down. So why not this one? Let's find out more. Tech expert Maha Yarmout, who is lead security researcher for cybersecurity company Kaspersky, has joined me in the studio. Maha, thank you so much for your time. Lovely to have you here.
Pleasure.
Are websites like this dodgy one common?
They are becoming more common because it's an evolution of different schemes, of different scammer schemes. So it's becoming more evolving. They are getting into different themes like the one here you just mentioned about the future museum, maybe the Louvre of Abu Dhabi. Maybe I've seen it common in the recruitment. Think of Dubai and the UAE as a big hub for expats and working abroad and so on. So it's really getting into the different themes of the scammer ecosystem.
They're basically just trying to get information and data out of you. Is that the general gist?
I mean, most of the time it's like that, but usually with such scheme where it involves a really good copy of the original website, they try to lure you to a different thing. Like, for example, you just mentioned that there's a payment system on the fake website that they try to lure you into paying and so forth. But even if there's no payment on the website, like the one I just mentioned for the recruitment, I've seen it quite often here that there's a really good copy of a hospital, for example, and scammers just use that fake website for another discussion off the record through emails. And when the victim fall for their scam, they just redirect the victims to pay through a fake agency, fake travel agency and so forth, so they can come here over Dubai.
So I think this website is still up. I think I've just found it. It's just dodgy. And the reason why you know it's dodgy is because it says that I can book tickets for the Museum of the Future for 149 dirhams and I can book them tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that that is not how much tickets to the Museum of the Future cost. And I know that there won't be any tickets available for tomorrow because it's a really popular site.
True.
I don't think it's real. And I think this is the site. Now, if I can tell with literally 20 seconds of research while I was chatting to you, that it's, you know, that this site is dodgy, how come no one's taken it down yet?
So think of this for scammers. It's just a legitimate website.
Okay.
Even if you look at it and you know that this is fake because you know the URL is fake or it's not real, maybe the content is not identical, there's something off, right?
Yeah. But what they're selling isn't real.
Exactly. But that takes time to be detected because you need more than just technical terms. You need visual identification and so forth. So in such cases, you just either report them to the cybercrime unit. Sometimes they are good and fast in taking down such websites. But again, it's really hard in technical terms to really detect such fake websites unless, for example, some major companies do have brand monitoring. They do detect such fake websites that they copy them. And that's becoming, depending on the region, may be becoming more prominent. And it's good that they detect it early in the stage. Otherwise, you just find them, report them either to the authorities or to, for example, us. The difference between reporting to cybercrime unit and to companies such as Kaspersky, we just put it on the blacklist and it gets blacklisted all over the world. For whoever have our agents, he gets blocked from this website because we labeled it as scamming.
It's really interesting to hear that basically it can come down to each and every individual to make the effort to report the website. Now, the way of doing that here with Dubai Police is you can literally just go to their website and there's loads of opportunities to report it there. And so I'm just trying to find the exact website as I'm speaking to you, which is that classic thing. Don't talk on the radio and search on websites. That's the first message. But Maha, thank you so much for talking us through how that works. We really appreciate your time, as always, here on The Agenda. Thank you. Great to have you join us. Maha Yarmout there, tech expert, lead security researcher for the cybersecurity company Kaspersky. Thank you very much for your time. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.